Falls puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
I always get a bit of a thrill when I hear that music because I know it heralds the arrival of Gordon Goldsborough from the Manitoba Historical Society. He's our weekend morning show history columnist, and he's here every week at this time. Hi, welcome back.
Good morning, Terry.
So last week you gave a hint suggesting you're going to take us somewhere where there is pink-colored stone that was used for cemetery monuments.
Yes, that's right. We're going to go visit an abandoned granite quarry in eastern Manitoba near the village of East Braintree.
Okay, tell me more about this. I'm fascinated with quarries.
Yeah, I am, and particularly when it involves sort of a local product. But we have to step back a little bit just to provide the context. If you remember, we talked about the Greater Winnipeg Water District.
Mm-hmm.
That's the facility that provided Winnipeg's water supply. They constructed an aqueduct between Shoal Lake and Winnipeg between 1913 and 1919. Well, they built a railway along the path for that aqueduct so that they could do service of it, they could maintain it. Well, this, of course, provided an enormous boon for the people in that area. They now had transportation out because this was a fairly undeveloped part of the province, quite, you know, almost a wilderness in some ways. And of course, remember, too, that this was the reason why, for example, the provincial government established a prison farm in that area. Okay, well, apparently, when they were doing the surveying for this route, for this railway, they discovered along one spot in the railway, they found an enormous deposit of granite. And I guess the word spread. And a fellow here in Winnipeg, a fellow named John Brooke, who had come here from England, he heard this. He was a dealer in marble and granite. And he thought, aha, this is a business opportunity. So he and his sons opened a business that was going to specialize in locally made or locally cut granite from this deposit. So they ended up buying one of the construction camps that had been put together for the aqueduct. They had, you know, bunkhouses and cookhouses and all that, so that they could then start quarrying this stone that was found right next to the railway. And so the idea was that they were going to deal in things like monuments, things like sort of cemetery stones, for example, statues of various kinds, you know, anything which they needed stone, buildings, you know.
Like facing stone?
Mm-hmm. Precisely. In fact, they really touted this as a real boon because architects that wanted to prescribe, you know, some fancy stone that they'd have to bring in from great distance. At this time, a lot of the stone was coming from places like Scotland. So, of course, transportation was an enormous cost. So the thinking was that if you could get this stone at a local source, the cost would be considerably less. And then this Brooke guy, because he apparently had a long history in the rock business, he claimed on numerous occasions that the stone here was, you know, every bit as good as the stuff in Scotland. In fact, he thought it was more diverse. There was many different kinds of granite here that he thought would be a real plus. So he bought this old construction camp along the railway, and he opened a quarry at, it was called Mile 79, but it was actually a very short distance away from the community of East Braintree. But of course, what he needed before he could actually start shipping the granite was he needed some facility to process it. You know, because when you blast these big chunks of rock, and by the way, these chunks of rock were enormous. Apparently, they were up to 135 tons, these big chunks of rock. And so they'd have to carve them into smaller pieces. And they had apparently a steam-powered crane that could lift rocks that were up to about 20 tons. So still big pieces of rock. And they'd load these onto a little railway car. They had a narrow-gauge railway there that they could use to move these blocks of rock, but they still had to cut them into smaller slabs. They had to polish them to make them nice and smooth and to reveal the beautiful texture inside. And so they built a mill house. This was a big facility. It was 5,800 square feet, you know, quite a bit bigger than your average home. And keep in mind, too, this was in the middle of relatively nowhere. They had to have electricity because they needed to run the machines that do all the cutting and the polishing.
So where did they get that?
Well, they had a motor. You know, they would run it probably
like
on
a generator.
A generator, like, you know, gasoline powered or kerosene or, you know, some fuel that ran it. And that's where they would do the polishing. And then they would have another narrow gauge railway that would take these polished rocks over to the railway, the water district railway, and would load them on that. Because although that railway was intended primarily to transport workers to the Shoal Lake, they thought, well, if they can make some money along the way by, you know, ferrying people back and forth, but even better, if you could ferry, you know, products back and forth, it would raise a little extra money to offset the cost of this railway. So he negotiated with the railway, and yes, he got a spur line installed there by the quarry. And so the whole thing seemed to be, you know, going gangbusters. He spent something like $125,000.
A lot of money back then.
Oh, for sure. I mean, because this is now 1918, 1919 that this is all happening. So this is a large sum of money. And a community started to develop. They had workers, of course, that would bring their families. They started building cottages for these families. They had kids, of course. The workers would have children. They had a school nearby, a midwinter school that the kids could attend. They even had telephone service to the outside world. So it was really the beginnings of a real bustling community.
I do have to ask, though, so exactly what color was this stone?
Well, it varied in color, actually, because the quarry advertised itself as having red and gray granite. So I'm guessing either that means it was sort of a mottled color, it was sort of a mixture of both, or it may have been they had some chunks that were redder and others that were grayer. But I'm told by people who've seen specimens that it's sort of a light sort of salmon pink.
I know that color. I've seen it. It's still quarried in northwestern Ontario.
That's right.
Near Vermilion Bay. I've been to that quarry. Mm-hmm. And they have that pink kind of granite there as well.
And I suspect it's the rock formations that are similar to that area. So, yeah, I suspect that that's predominantly the color of the rock there.
So how long did his quarry last? It sounds like a great business idea.
Well, it sounded like it, sure. And he was thinking big, that he thought that there was going to be a population eventually of 18,000 people, and there was going to be so much, there was more granite there than in all of Scotland, and it was the only granite quarry west of the Great Lakes at that time. He had big plans. Well, unfortunately, it lasted 2 years. It operated in 1919. It operated in 1920. He brought on investors, but it seemed that something happened to the business. It closed for the winter in 1920, in the fall of 1920. It never reopened in 1921. And you know, I've speculated about what that reason could have been. And the only reason that I've heard is that if you think back to what was happening in 1918, 1919, 1920.
Yeah, I was trying to figure that, yeah.
Well, we had the 1919 flu pandemic. You know, the flu that swept across the world.
Right, with all the soldiers coming home from the war.
That's right. Yeah. And many people, many civilians died. And of course, as a result, they had to be buried. There was funeral, of course, requirements. Vast numbers of people would have to be buried. And of course, you'd think, well, that would be a good business then to have if you were a granite dealer, because they'd need monuments. But this is where it takes an interesting twist, because one of the investors in this quarry was a fellow named A.S. Bardal. And you've probably heard of that name.
Bardal Funeral Companies.
Precisely. Yeah. It's a long-standing.
There are a couple of Bardals.
That's
yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think the company is still existing in some form. It's been a long-standing company. A.S. Bardal was the founder of that. He was an investor. And I think he was a smart guy. He thought this was an opportunity to obtain monuments relatively inexpensively. Well, unfortunately, what they discovered in the aftermath of this flu pandemic is that many people who were buried couldn't pay their bills. And apparently quite a lot of undertakers went under literally after the pandemic, because they just simply couldn't pay the bills because nobody was paying them. And so he pulled back, and I guess that was what caused it. So in the late 1921, this Mr. Brooke tried to get new investors, you know, and because he was thinking, well, another opportunity that's really becoming popular now is a lot of the soldiers who had been killed during the First World War, they wanted to erect monuments for them. And all over Manitoba, you know, today, if you visit virtually any small community, any large community, there is a monument for the First World War veterans who were killed. And so his thinking was, well, hey, here's still an opportunity. So he took a bunch of women from the Imperial Order Daughters of the Empire.
IODE.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they were one of the active groups that was lobbying communities to put up these monuments. He thought, well, here's an opportunity for me to maybe get them on board to reactivate this quarry. But apparently I guess the interest wasn't there, and it never reopened. So they appointed a caretaker who looked after the place for a few years, but eventually I guess the money ran out and it just ended.
What remains at the abandoned site?
Well, the mill house where they had milled this stone was on a concrete foundation with brick walls. I think what happened is that the locals scavenged it for bricks. And that's why you see so many brick structures in that area. They took down this mill house. It was a large building. And now all that's left is the remains of the foundation, the concrete. And that's how you can tell, for example, of the size of it, because you can still step out the remains of this foundation. The mounts for these machinery is still there. For that generator that would have provided the electricity, it's still there. And of course, the quarry is still there.
I have wondered about that.
Yeah, well, course, it was a big open pit at one point. And there's big blocks of stone. I guess presumably there was occasionally blocks that were cleaved off that had flaws in them, so they couldn't use them. They would just push those to one side. And they're all still laying there. So you can wander around in the quarry itself, and you can see the bore holes they would have drilled to I guess, do the blasting. So there's actually quite a lot left that you can see. But in the middle of the building where the mill house was, you can see these enormous trees, you know, that indicate how long ago this site had been abandoned.
How could we get there?
Well, the easiest way really is just to go to East Braintree. It's just a short distance from the village itself. I wouldn't have found it were it not for the help of a listener who suggested I go and have a look at it. So I was able, therefore, to get a precise latitude and longitude. And if you go to the Historical Society website, you can get the coordinates and it'll take you right to the mill house building itself.
And you, of course, travel with a GPS.
Of course.
Gordon, this is great yarn. What do you have for us next week?
Well, we're going to visit a site in Winnipeg that is long known for its connection with direct sales, such as will be done by door-to-door salesmen.
Okay. Sounds interesting. Look forward to it. See you next week.
See you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba, many moons.